It isn't exactly a secret world, but unless you're a Beltway type, the workings of lobbyists can come across as mysterious and complicated. The influence of lobbyists behind the scenes in politics is enormous. So today on Please Explain, we thought that we would try to learn more about what lobbyists do and the impact that they have on government. And we've invited Alex Bloomberg, a contributing editor for NPR's Planet Money, to explain things. He's also a producer of This American Life and an adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University. So I'm very pleased to welcome you to this edition of Please Explain. And we also invite our audience, our listeners, to join in on the discussion on these segments. Our number is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. You recently worked on these extremely interesting stories on the subject of lobbying for This American Life and Morning Edition. Did you know a lot about the subject before you worked on them?
I didn't really know that much. I mean, I wasn't, you know, at This American Life, you don't have a beat. And so what we do is we sort of, you know, just sort of drop ourselves into something and try to become as familiar with it as possible. But there are definitely people who know far more about lobbying than I do. What I was interested in, though, is sort of where the moment where the money changes hands, because you hear a lot about sort of aggregate numbers. Where does the, you know, how much is spent by this industry? How much is, you know, how much is spent per year? Who, you know, if this politician is getting this much money from individuals versus PACs, but it's all sort of abstract.
But is it always money? Aren't there favors often exchanged? And in some cases, it seems to me, lobbyists give legislators complete bills to enter, and it's in their best interest because it will help the folks back in the home area or whatever.
Oh, there's no question. Well, so most lobbyists were former staffers. Almost, yeah, I think it's, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's massive. You know, I would imagine it's in the 90% or something like that. So most lobbyists started as staffers. They started writing legislation anyway, or being around people who are writing legislation. And yeah, absolutely. Like, if you're a good lobbyist, what you, you know, I had a staffer tell me that, like, you know, people are busy. The legislators are really busy. A lot of their busyness is because they have to raise these massive amounts of money, which is, I think, the key to the whole thing. So I hope we come back to that. But yeah, so if somebody can come and sort of say, here's what we think the legislation should look like, it's helpful.
And legislation often runs to many pages. Antonin Scalia complained during the hearings about the Obama health care plan that he was expected to read 2,500 pages of the law.
And and I think often it is that long because there are special interests who say, well, I don't want this provision to affect us in this way. And so you have to, so there's like a loophole or a carve out there. And it's a lot of it is because of lobbying.
Well, what about special interests? We hear that phrase a lot. Is a special interest group just a good government group in one person's eyes and something quite different in another, depending on your political viewpoint?
Well, I had a former lobbyist tell me, and I think this is accurate. You know, he said, your aunt in Dubuque is a special interest. You know, the Sierra Club is a special interest. The NRA is a special interest. Goldman Sachs is a special interest. Anybody who is interested in the outcome of legislation is a special interest, and that's pretty much everybody. The issue is which special interests have money to contribute. And that's where it really comes back to. One of the most fascinating things I learned, the thing that I didn't fully appreciate, but I think everybody inside really knows this. But, you know, we have this image of, like, the lobbyist is the one who sort of stalks the halls and finds the congressman and says, hey, you know, I got some money for you.
In fact, the word lobby comes from the fact that they used to wait in the halls, in the lobbies, and then pigeonhole.
Yeah,
The legislators as they came by.
Right. But the idea, I think our image is that the lobbyist is somehow sort of influencing the legislator with money and sort of saying, here's this money, do what I want. And I found it to be the exact opposite. Basically, every single legislator needs so much cash to get elected. It's like, you know, it's millions of dollars each cycle. You know, that's every 2 years you need millions of dollars. And it's hard to get that from regular people. Lobbyists have the cash. So literally, the congresspeople call the lobbyists. Their staffs call the lobbyists.
And that's something that I had never thought of before I heard your piece on This American Life. I always assumed the lobbyists were hounding the the people in
that
Congress.
That goes on. It doesn't go on.
I think there's on the health care plan, there were 6 lobbyists for every member of Congress. So there are a lot of lobbyists out there trying to be heard. But what you revealed was that the lobbyists often don't want to answer the phone because they get all these calls from the people in Congress who are asking them for a favor.
Right. And if you're a lobbyist, you know, I need so I'm targeting this particular person because they're in leadership on this committee that I care about. So if I'm a healthcare lobbyist and I know that the healthcare bill is being, you know, the Ways and Means, there's a subcommittee that's dealing with this healthcare legislation that affects insurance companies, and I'm part of an insurance company. I know I don't care about anybody else except the people on that subcommittee. If I'm known around town as a lobbyist who works for a big insurance company, I have lots of, you know, that insurance company has a big PAC, which is the way they give the money out. I might get calls from all sorts of people that I don't care about. So I'm going to dodge those calls because I don't care about giving them money.
Well, if they're on the wrong committee, you mean.
Yeah, if they're on
and
the wrong committee.
And that's why being assigned to the right committee is really important for somebody who wants to get reelected?
Yeah.
And it isn't only because you really feel strongly about foreign policy?
No. And as a matter of fact, so we actually had this really interesting conversation with this guy, Jeff Flake, who's a Republican congressman from Arizona. And he said he's one of the few people, I think, in the world and certainly in Congress who really deeply has a really, really deep and profound interest in the tax code. Like, that is his hobby. But the Ways and Means Committee is the committee that deals with the tax code. And he said, I wouldn't even try to get on that committee because that is a fundraising committee. And so the point of that committee is when you get on that committee, your fundraising potential is so huge because every corporation that's interested in the tax code, which is pretty much every corporation, is going to lobby you and going to, as part of that lobbying, they're going to give you campaign contributions. And then in return, you have to really, really do a lot of the fundraising. So you're actually assessed. This is all not official, but it's all both parties do this. If you're on Ways and Means, your party knows you can raise a lot more money. And so your party will tell you to stay on that committee, you have to kick some of that money back. So your fundraising duties go up. And he said, I love the tax code, but I can't put in the hours in fundraising that I would need to be on that committee.
That's like the waiters having to give some money to the busboys.
Absolutely, right. except they're all waiters, and some waiters just aren't getting any tips.
So let's talk a bit about lobbying as it was and as it is today. We've already discussed this change where the Congress people call the lobbyists. They're calling them also because they want them to set up fundraisers for them.
Yeah. So the fundraiser is one of the I think of that as the atomic unit of this world of fundraising. The fundraiser, I think most of us think of this sort of like this gala black tie, you know, with sort of like stars performing and sort of $35,000 plate dinner. Those go on, but they're sort of at the presidential level. But there's this much more ubiquitous sort of everyday occurrence. It's happened, you know, 10, 15, 20 times a day.
Breakfasts and lunches.
Throughout D.C. Breakfasts and lunches at these little and every sort of upscale, mid-scale eatery in D.C. almost has like a couple of side rooms where it's like 10, 15, 20 people can just meet. And what it is the congressman and the congressman's, you know, fundraiser are there. And then maybe 10, 15, 20 lobbyists sort of around a table or whatever. And they happen breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And we asked people like, you know, you go to these things. And generally there's an invitation that goes out. We're inviting people to them, and then you can. And there's basically a price of admission. Here's how much it will cost to come and sit at this breakfast or lunch or dinner with this congressperson, and it can range from like $500 to $5,000.
With the hopes of being able to get the ear of the member of Congress.
Yeah, and think about that as how valuable that is. If you're lobbying for some issue or another, if you can actually sit and it's just you and a couple people around a table for an hour, that is very valuable access.
My guest is Alex Bloomberg. We're talking about lobbying, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Can anyone become a lobbyist? You say most of them were former government aides.
Yeah, you and I couldn't, I don't think. I mean, nobody would pay us to. I mean, you can go and stand in the lobby and try to get somebody to do something for you. But I don't think anybody would, I don't think a big lobbying firm would hire you and me because we don't have the skills that they're looking for.
Do you have to be registered?
You have to register. Most lobbyists are registered. There's certain ways that you can skirt the registration rules, and I'm not familiar with exactly how that is.
Although we've heard about some of that in the news. The House first required lobbyists to register back in 1876. So this has been an American tradition for a long time. Do you have any idea whether there are lobbyists in the British House of Commons or the French Parliament?
I mean, lobbying is a great thing. I think that is the whole part of democracy, is that, like, if you're a group, you should be able to petition your government. So lobbying, to me, if it is simply, you know, a group of people trying to make their case to their elected representatives, there's nothing wrong with that. I think, to me, that what's interesting about the system is that right now, lobbying and fundraising are linked. So right now, if you're a lawmaker, you need this money. The lobbyists have the money. And so every time you're hearing arguments, you're also getting this check that you need. And that was what we were trying to look at. What does the check do to the argument?
And you had one lobbyist say that he wanted to have the check actually handed to him, no credit
Talbot.
Cards or anything. Yeah. And that's because the transaction had to be made quite clear.
Yeah, he wanted – I mean, I think what he was saying is basically, we want you to remember we gave you this check. So when you're voting on something, you'll remember us.
What is a day in the life of a lobbyist like? Are they mostly doing these fundraisers, or are they writing new laws and regulations in hopes that someone will – and I'm assuming it's not just people in Congress but also people in the administration – will then use them?
I mean, there's lots and lots of different types of lobbyists. We talk to generally the – and there's a lobbyists that are just for hire where, you know – They build themselves as where we have access to government, and whatever your issue, come and get us.
A Jack Abramoff type.
And there's lobbying firms, the K Street lobbying firms. That's generally what they do. They'll just take their clients and go. And then there's other lobbyists who work for specific interests, like, you know, the banking industry or real estate or whatever.
Generally, or the AARP.
Or the AARP or the Sierra Club or the NRA, whatever. A lot of the ones that are attached to sort of the large industries that have a lot of money, I mean, they go to a lot of these fundraisers. We talked to lobbyists who were going, you know, he said, Scott Talbot, he was a financial services industry lobbyist. He said you could go morning, noon, and night and to a dinner.
What's the difference between a lobbyist or a registered lobbyist and a senior advisor working in Washington on behalf of a company or special interest group?
I'm not exactly sure what the technical difference is. I mean, I think there's all sorts of gray areas around, you know, the lobbyist has to register. But I'm sure there's all sorts of loopholes in how you can register, as we know from Newt Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich is one example. And now all of this talk about the ALEC group, they claim that they're a charity. And it seems to me the tax laws play a major role in this as well. Because lobbyists will be taxed differently than a philanthropic group. So if you can convince people like that ALEC is really just a charity, well, then when the people who want ALEC to work as lobbyists for them are making a philanthropic donation, and they don't even have to pay taxes on it.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely beneficial treatment to being registered as a not-for-profit. There's
the American Legislation Exchange Council. They actually write legislation, and they offer it to legislators not just in Washington but all over the country.
All over the country, yeah. And so what we reported on stuff that's happening in Washington, but I think the same type of thing is happening everywhere. It costs a lot of money to get a seat, whether that seat is in your state or for the federal government.
One lobbyist I read about said remind people listening to please explain on the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC, WNYC.org. I am Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking with Alex Bloomberg, who is a contributing editor for NPR's Planet Money and also a producer of This American Life and an adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. A listener asks, Senator Carl Krueger was sentenced to 7 years in prison for bribery. Why did he get jail time? What's the difference between that and what you've been talking about?
The difference can seem very technical. Bribery, from my understanding, is so if there are laws about how much you can contribute, so you can max out to a specific candidate. And then there's also, all this money that's changing hands is not going to the lawmakers personally. It's going to their campaign committees because they need all this cash to run their campaigns, to buy the TV ads and the mailers and all that sort of stuff. So if you're taking some of that money and diverting it directly to your bank account, that is absolutely bribery, and that's obviously against the law. So if he was getting some of that money personally, then that is very clearly a violation of the law. But in terms of the effect, you know, the lawmakers need this money. The lobbyists many times have the money, and so there is this sort of meeting of need and ability, you know?
Most people think that politicians gain all their campaign funds by going to friends and supporters. But it sounds to me like the bulk of it comes from lobbyists.
Yeah, and there's actually, you know, there's an interesting progression that you can sometimes see where originally, you just start out and it's your first campaign. You're fighting the incumbent. You're a challenger. You generate all this enthusiasm in your district, and a lot of times you do have a lot of money from your friends, your contributors, the people in the district. Then you get to D.C. and then you're there a couple of years, and it's harder to get those checks out of those same people. Like they're like, oh, it's 2 years ago. I just gave you a check. Now you're back, and so you see over time that As the longer people are in Congress, the more they start to rely on the D.C. circuit of lobbyists and special interests because it's just easier to get those guys to write a big check. And, I mean, most of us are not going to write a $5,000 check to our congressman. That is just like out of, you know, that we're just not capable of doing that. But, you know, for a lobbyist, that's sort of the cost of doing business.
But are they also bankrolling the PACs?
The lobbyists?
The political, yes.
So the way it works is, so the PAC is, associated with an industry. So if there's the PAC is basically, you can think of it as the bank account for whatever an industry is. And then the lobbyists, if they're working for that same industry, so say the National Association of Realtors or whatever, they'll have a PAC, and then the lobbyists will, and then the PAC will write the checks, and then the lobbyists will go and lobby. And so the lobbyist isn't actually writing the check themselves. It's usually coming from the PAC.
Mm-hmm. Well, the PACs now are deeply involved in the political process and bankrolling ads. Both
right.
As a result of Citizens United, we're seeing a whole game change here. The lobbyists involved in that as well?
Well, yeah. So that's the very, very interesting thing. Lobbyists now, what's really interesting now, so it used to be you had limits on how much you could contribute. So you know, a lobbyist, you can only give, you know, it gets, when you do, when if you really, really, really wanted to give as much as you could to a candidate, I think it maxes out at like $38,000. That's the maximum you could give to a candidate, something like that. But now with Citizens United, there is unlimited amounts of money that can go in, but you're not supposed to coordinate. So, and that, you know, there's, so, you know, and so you have these things where like, you know, former staff members go and start these super PACs that then take unlimited donations, and then they sort of run ads for their former bosses.
One lobbyist I read about said, once you get into this business, you have to be a draft horse and you have to wear blinders. Do you know what he meant?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he meant is that you just sort of like, it's just a slog. Because you know, you can't think about the other side of the other person's point of view very much. And you have to just sort of like every day you're sort of going to these fundraisers and sort of pitching people.
An article in the Huffington Post yesterday written by Dan Frumkin seemed to indicate that while the tendency used to be for interest groups to spend their resources more or less equally in support of Republicans and Democrats, usually giving more to whichever party was in power at the time, that might be changing.
You know, I don't know. I'm not familiar with that article. I know that the financial services industry, which is sort of where I, you know, specialize more than anything else, I believe they gave more to the Obama campaign in 2008.
But not this
election. Year. And now it's switched. And people don't quite, you know, I mean, like, you know, some there's all sorts of theories about why that is.
Now, how much did we learn about how lobbyists operate from the Jack Abramoff scandal? And do you think that that other people are still doing pretty much the same sort of thing?
I mean, I don't think we learned that much, frankly, because to me, I think what Jack Abramoff does is he reinforces this notion that there is a there are people out there who cross the line and into out-and-out bribery, and then there's everybody else, and everything else is just totally kosher. And what I found is that the system is, you know, what he did was extreme, and most lobbyists don't do what he did. But there is this, again, it's the system where...
Well, he was scamming his clients.
He was scamming his clients, although I've talked to him and he says he wasn't scamming his clients. But anyway, but I think also... But I think basically what he was, yeah, so he was scamming his clients. But I think the basic dynamic there was the same. You know, I actually interviewed him, and he said the same thing that a lot of other lobbyists said, is that, you know, your basic tool, he called it literally the lobbyist safecracker kit, is the fundraiser. Writing those, you know, $2,000, $5,000 checks, getting in front of the congressman that you're trying to influence, and making yourself indispensable to their campaign.
And he had an advantage in the fact that he owned a restaurant, so he actually could hold the fundraisers in his own restaurant.
Yeah, exactly, and that was get revenue from that as well.
What about the groups that watch the lobbyists try to monitor their influence? The Center for Responsive Politics, the consumer group Public Citizen, and others. Do they have much of an impact on how business is conducted?
I think they do a little bit. I mean, it's unclear about if you want to do something about this situation, if you think this situation is a problem, it's unclear what exactly, you know, you do. But what a lot of these groups is just, they just try to track the money. And I think that does, you know, there's this group that I used a lot in my reporting, the Sunlight Foundation, and they have this great web tool. It's called politicalpartytime.org. And basically what they do is they just get people to anonymously send them invitations to these fundraisers. And I would urge people to go and check out politicalpartytime.org. It's really just really fascinating just looking at these invitations.
Has there been any fallout from the Planet Money pieces on This American Life and Morning Edition?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's hearings every day now. No, nothing. I mean, there hasn't been.
Did you expect more of a response?
No, I wanted to, you know, you never know what sort of effect your report is going to have. But I don't think, I mean, there's been a lot of response in terms of like people really, really seem to appreciate it and enjoy it and wrote to us and said that, you know, it's weird how this issue, it's sort of after McCain-Feingold, which was the legislation in the early 2000s that sort of like really took a big swing at, you know, trying to curb the effect of money in politics. A lot of the attention of this issue, it sort of died down. And I think after Citizens United and the super PACs, I think there's going to be a lot more attention coming to this issue of money in politics and what the money is actually buying.
We've got to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write into our show page at WNYC.org. My guest is Alex Bloomberg, who is a contributing editor for NPR's Planet Money. He is also a producer of This American Life, and when he isn't doing those things, he's an adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University. Give us a call, 212-433-9692. We're back with Alex Bloomberg, who works for both NPR and also PRI, because This American Life is produced by PRI, and Planet Money is something that NPR has organized. And we're talking about lobbying and inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Dorian from Manhattan has written in to ask, there's a perception that corporate America has more influence on the lobbying than other groups, such as environmental groups. What do you think?
The numbers certainly bear that out. There's a guy named Lee Drutman who has done some research on this. And he found, I can't remember exactly, it was like either 4-1 or 5-1 in terms of money comes from corporations versus nonprofits or not-for-profit groups. So, yeah, definitely, there's a lot more money spent by corporate America than by not-for-profit America.
And Jesse on the Upper West Side writes in on the recent issue of SOPA, which has been replaced now by new legislation. But anyway, on the recent issue of SOPA, a lot of protesters assumed that they had influence in bringing the legislation down. On a closer look, it seems that the likes of Google and American Express, who opposed it, actually got it shut down. And it turns out that SOPA was corporation versus corporation.
So that SOPA is a really interesting issue. And I'm cynical, but I don't want to get too cynical. And lots of Congress people told me, if it comes down to straight money versus voters, the voters will always win because the voters are really who you need to please to keep your job, and the money is simply a way to reach the voters. So I don't want to minimize the effect that the online protests had about SOPA. That being said, the money from Google probably helped as well. But if it was just the money from Google, I think that legislation would have easily passed. I think it had a lot to do with the uproar, and I think that surprised a lot of people in Congress.
Let's go to Peter from the Bronx. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello, Leonard and Adam. I have a question similar to
he's Alex, by the way.
People who wrote in was. You often hear about special interests and lump together unions and corporations, etc. But I'm wondering what the ratio of corporate business money is to labor unions. I would also ask you about environmental groups, but you've answered that.
I don't know the exact ratio of corporations to labor unions, but I would assume that it's the same. I would assume that corporate America has more money in lobbying than labor unions,
especially since labor unions seem to be losing members at a very fast rate.
But labor unions are a big, big political contributor. So I don't want to minimize there are people who have a lot of influence, you know, among the people that they support.
Well, right now we're seeing something of that sort in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Where Scott Walker passed some what people perceived as very anti-union legislation in the state legislature, and he's now facing a recall.
Yeah, absolutely, and you see it in California.
And that's because of money that was put in to the campaign by unions and other organizations.
And you see it a lot in California. I've heard people tell me that like the prison unions have a lot of influence in California over you know sort of their criminal justice issues in California, and they're big contributors in California as well. So, yeah, it's every, you know, they're big players.
Pete from Riverdale, you're on the air.
Yeah, I appreciate the conversation so far, and it's dealt, I see, primarily with federal lobbying. But we have a big lobbying operation in the state of New York, and I assume other states as well, dealing with the state legislature that probably has more effect on individuals' lives than the federal government does, and the city as well. And you haven't addressed governmental lobbies. The city of New York has a lobbying operation in Albany that is equal to many of the unions or anything else. I mean, and they supply information to the legislators who, have you indicated, certainly on a federal level or on a state and city level as well, are overwhelmed and don't have the staff or the ability to get the information that the lobbying group could supply to them.
Yeah. I mean, no question. It sounds like you know more about this than I do, but I would imagine that the city of New York in the state of New York is a very, very big player. You know, there's a lot of money here, and there's going to be a lot of power that comes with that.
And I assume that happens with most cities that have a certain amount of economic clout.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chicago, Los Angeles, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And the point about information, I mean, that is a big one. Like, lots and lots of Barney Frank told me that almost every time you meet with a lobbyist, the lobbyist knows more about the issue than you do. That, like, the I don't want to minimize. In fact, I want to emphasize, lobbyists know a lot. They know their stuff. And so, you know, they're all experts in their field.
And they see part of their job is educating.
Absolutely.
The people they're trying to influence.
Yeah, and I don't think you would ever, you know, you don't want to pass a banking law without talking to bankers. That would be absurd, obviously, right? But the issue is how much. Who else are you talking to? Are you only talking to the bankers because they're the ones who can pay to get access to you?
We now have Kevin from Queens on the line. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big Planet Money fan.
Oh, great.
I want to know why Congress people with very safe seats have to spend so much time raising money.
Oh, that's a really good question. So the answer is because if they want to rise up in the ranks of leadership, they have to raise money. This comes back again to the sort of the dynamics within the parties. So one way to get into leadership is to raise a ton of money and then spread it around to people in tight districts or competitive districts or having trouble with their own fundraising. So
and the higher they are in leadership, though, it means the fundraising duties, obligations only increase.
Exactly.
So what's the real lure of leadership then?
You'd have to ask. I think generally people who seek elective office are like to be in charge.
Yeah.
So I think it just continues once you get in there.
But is it really a safe seat? Look at what's happening now with Orrin Hatch and Lugar.
Right.
They are being challenged within their own parties.
Well, there's
Richard Lugar. So it is a safe seat isn't always a safe seat in the way you might imagine it would be. That the state may always vote Republican in the case of Utah, but that doesn't mean that Orrin Hatch won't be challenged by another Republican.
Absolutely, there's a couple of issues there. One, that comes back to money because. If you're heavily supported by a special interest and you want to get away and you feel like I'm going to want to go in a different direction, you know that that special interest not only might not fund you anymore if you've been supported by the banks but you vote against the banks, but they'll actually fund your challenger. So that's a big issue. And then a lot of that has to do with the Citizens United case. Again, there is just so much money now coming in. Nobody's safe. And we heard that over and over.
And that's true for Democrats as well. Two
Absolutely.
Democrats recently lost primaries because they had voted against the health care bill, and more liberal groups campaigned against them, put money into their campaigns, and they lost to more liberal challengers.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think you know, Citizens United makes it easier to do that because now these liberal challengers, you know, there's like, you know, you can if you can raise $1 million in one meeting with a wealthy person who is really, really, you know, wants universal health care, you know, you can mount a successful change.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. George from Queens, you're on the air.
Yes, just a quick question to your guest. We in Africa constantly get this criticism from politicians in the West and journalists in the West. My question is, why is it that it's been allowed, corruption, I mean, allowed in the U.S. and in the Western world? Then go around and criticize Africans for doing the same thing that you do here.
I think there is a if you're asking me if there's a lot of triumphalist rhetoric from American politicians when it comes to Africa
and hypocrisy,
I think there's you get no
But George, it is also a matter of degree. I don't think that we've heard of too many American politicians taking foreign aid and then stashing it in Swiss bank accounts.
Yeah, and I definitely want to make that point. Like, I think this is the system that has been created. It's a legal system. Most people are trying to operate, I think, honorably within this system. I feel like that's why I'm trying to walk this line between sort of like, this is the way it works, but it doesn't mean that everybody in the system is corrupt. Quite the opposite. I think 95% of the people in the system are trying to do what they believe.
But if I said, I'm not going to take any money from lobbyists,
yeah,
wouldn't I be committing political suicide?
There are people who can almost do it. There are people who have very safe district, lots of rich friends, don't care a ton about leadership, and you can exist as a congressperson without taking too much money from lobbyists. It's true, but if you want to, I mean, the other point about leadership, you can't get much done unless you're in a leadership position. So if you get to Congress and then you're just one of 435 and you can't do anything, you know, what's the point of that? So I think that's another drive for leadership. It actually gives you the ability to do what you wanted to do in the first place, which was influence policy.
That's why you became a politician.
That's why you became a politician.
At least in theory.
Yeah.
Although there may be other reasons, as Leonard from Forest Hills wants to ask about. Hi, Leonard.
Hi. What I'd like to know is the net worth of the senators and congressmen when they first come into office and their net worth when they leave.
I'm not sure. So here's what I think about that. I don't think you get into Congress and then people give you money while you're in Congress and you enrich yourself. That is not what happens.
But they give you stock tips, as we've learned.
Indications of a number of people, on a small occasion, where their net worth seemed to be way out of proportion as to what they were earning while they were in office.
Right. And so, there's definitely, as we've learned, that you can get your stock tips. But again, the checks that they're getting, if it's legal, those checks are not going to them personally. It's going to their campaign committee. Now, obviously, once you leave office, if you weren't already a millionaire to begin with, you can go and work for a top lobbying organization. And if you were a sitting congressperson with, you know, some sort of power and influence, then you can make a lot of money as a lobbyist.
Thank you so much for your call. A number of people have written in with questions that I see as kind of similar, so I'm going to ask all three.
Sure.
And we can group them together. A listener in Rockland County asked, if campaigns were paid for equitably by the government, would there still be a need for lobbyists? And then Shana on Twitter asks, would corporate lobbyists have as much power if their corporations couldn't donate as much to campaigns and political action committees? And a listener asks, Wired magazine this month has an article promoting small group democracy as a way to get money out of politics. Could it work?
I think the question about if we got rid of money in politics, would there still be lobbyists? And should there still be lobbyists? I think absolutely there should still be lobbyists. Lobbyists are an essential part of democracy, I believe. And I think what troubles me is the link between lobbyists and money, that in order to hear the lobbyist argument, you need to bring a check with you. And otherwise, your argument might not be heard or heard with the same frequency. So if you want to get rid of money in politics, if you think that's a good idea, how do you do it? There's a bunch of proposals on the table. You know, public financing is something that comes up over and over again. There's lots of problems with that because basically then you're having the government. Somebody has to pay for the money goes to basically advertising on TV. So if you're publicly financing an election, you're having government raising, you know, taking lots and lots of money and then giving it to TV stations, you know.
There was also that checkoff on our tax returns. Uh-huh. It didn't bring in loads of money.
Right. And I think that's like a, you know, right, exactly. It's not going to bring in loads of money. If you want your tax dollars to go to, you know, to attack ads, clearly, I don't think there's that many people who want that.
So we're caught in a bind. On the one hand, it's difficult not to see this as very complicated and cynical business. But you say that you wouldn't want to see a world without lobbyists. Well, how do we work that out?
I mean, it comes back to me. To lobbyists, lobbyists are like, I feel like part of my goal here was to sort of resurrect the name of lobbyist a little bit, in that lobbyists, I think, get a bad rap because they deliver the checks. And if there wasn't the check associated with them, I think what they do would simply be advocacy, you know, and I think it's perfectly reasonable for insurance companies to have advocates, just as it's perfectly reasonable for patients to have advocates. It just seems like you don't want the playing field to be level. You don't want the insurance company to be coming with lots of money that the congresspeople need and the patients not as much.
And that's the way it tends
to be
right now.
And that's the way it is right now in our system. And so how do you address that? Is it through specifically, you know, limiting the problem with addressing it? I will say this, is that historically it hasn't been, so it's tough just on its face to come up with the right idea. And then you've got the Supreme Court and the Constitution. We can come back to that if you want.
Alex Blumberg is a contributing editor for NPR's Planet Money. He is also a producer of This American Life. And I want to thank you so much for helping us understand lobbyists on today's edition of Please Explain.
Thanks so much, Leonard.